Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of True Story on the Authors on Air. I'm your host, Brian Freeman, and I'm the author of 14 best-selling psychological thrillers. What we do on this show is help you discover nonfiction storytellers who will keep you turning the pages the way a great thriller writer does. But, of course, every story they tell is absolutely true. Okay, are you ready for some glamour today? We are going back to Hollywood in the 1950s. Elizabeth Taylor, Rock Hudson, James Dean. That's right, we have big, big stars and a book about a big, big movie. In fact, it's not just big, it's giant. Giant was a 1956 epic film, and it runs nearly 3.5 hours in length, so I do mean epic. It was based on Edna Ferber's best-selling novel of ranchers, oil, and racial conflict set deep in the heart of Texas. It won George Stevens the Oscar for Best Director and received 9 other Academy Award nominations, and it featured 3 of the most charismatic stars of the post-war Hollywood era. But it may be best known today as the last film James Dean made before his tragic death. My guest today is Don Graham, and he is the author of Giant, Elizabeth Taylor, Rock Hudson, James Dean, Edna Ferber, and the Making of a Legendary American Film. This is an absolutely fascinating book. I just loved going through it. It peels back the curtain on both the glamour and the seamy underbelly of Hollywood in the 1950s. Not that it seems like things have changed much since then. And honestly, I have to say it's also kind of a guilty pleasure, too, because the gossipy stories about Taylor, Hudson, and Dean are almost too wild to believe. And if you think I'm kidding about that, well, wait until you get to the section about how much James Dean liked to urinate in front of strangers. Now, Don, I don't know how you follow that particular anecdote, but welcome to True Story.
All right, thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, let's start with the book that led to the movie that led to your book, if we can follow that. Edna Ferber's book, Giant, it was a huge bestseller when it came out in 1952, but it was not exactly a love letter to Texas, was it?
No, it was. And the book was almost unanimously reviewed throughout Texas by male reviewers, I should add, in a very negative light. They didn't like her exaggerations. They didn't like her unrelenting criticism of Texas, but there were a lot of readers who liked her book because she was a best-selling author, and women readers on the whole tended to like her work a lot more. But the male reviewers were relentless in their attacks on her, and she was a very feisty woman. She fought back pretty hard. She got all upset because a guy in Houston said if she had come down to Houston, there'd be a lynch party, and that was just an example of Texas exaggeration. They didn't really mean that, but anyway, she thought they did. And so what George Stevens had to do was he had to figure out how to make a film that Texans would like. He didn't want to come down here and make a film that would just offend everybody, and so he set out an elaborate campaign to kind of get the Texas feel right. He studied Texas a lot, and he did a brilliant job, really, of capturing many aspects of the state.
Well, you talk about the fact that Elizabeth Taylor got to Texas and looked around and asked, "Where are we?"
I think all of them. I think she spoke for everybody when she asked that.
Well, how did that culture clash of Hollywood and Texas work out?
Well, the Texans embraced the film. The brilliant thing that George Stevens did was to have an open set, which was very rarely done in those days. It's very rare today as well. And he invited all of West Texas and anybody else in Texas to come and visit the set while they were filming. So this was the summer of 1955. It was a very hot summer, of course, in Texas. And there wasn't much to do. This was before television was really kicking in a strong way. And so families would come from all over West Texas and bring their children and spend a day watching these glamorous figures that they would never have had a chance to see otherwise. And at the same time, he brought in a bunch of, or the studio brought in a bunch of journalists to cover so there were reports coming out almost daily, newspaper accounts going to all parts of the country about the progress, and it was just a spectacular bit of insight on his part to kind of dull any kind of attack that might have been mounted by the press because this film was being made.
Well, I thought you did a great job, too, of capturing what life was like on the set back then. I mean, the boredom, the antics, the pettiness, the rivalries, the friendships, the misbehavior. It sounds like it was just this fascinating little community
right.
as the film was being made.
Well, these were very talented people, and there were people on there that I think would be a surprise to a lot of viewers or listeners today, like Dennis Hopper was in this film. He was a very young guy. It was his first major film. He had a small part in Rebel Without a Cause. But I think the whole operation or the whole experience of filming in Texas was multiplied or intensified, I put it that way, by James Dean. James Dean was just this amazingly irritating and fascinating character who drove just about everybody crazy. He became best friends with Elizabeth Taylor, as did Rock Hudson, and there was a kind of rivalry between Hudson and Dean as to who was going to hold the attention of this beautiful Elizabeth Taylor. And, of course, they didn't have the interest in her that some other people might have had because Rock was famously gay, and James Dean was probably bi, so far as we can tell. But Elizabeth Taylor was just great. She became very, very lifetime friends with both of them.
We look back now on those three actors, and they're kind of Hollywood royalty now. But back then,
right.
I mean, this was really an important film for all of their careers, wasn't it?
It was crucial for Rock Hudson. It was absolutely. Rock Hudson was 29 years old, and this would be the best part he would ever have and the best role he ever had. And he knew it going in. And he beat out all the competition in Hollywood, which was really stiff, from William Holden to many, many other leading male stars who wanted to play the main part of the rancher. And Rock Hudson got it. Elizabeth Taylor was 23, right. And she was just coming off 2 months away from a pregnancy, I mean, from having delivered her second baby. So she wanted to get out of these kind of silly, trivial roles that her studio kept putting her in. So she was loaned out to Warner Brothers, and she had worked with Stevens before on another great film of his called A Place in the Sun. But this was a very important film for her. I think both she and Rock Hudson should have won Academy Awards for their performances, but they didn't. And then it turned out to be James Dean's final film. Now he was third star, but he was only in the film about 30 minutes, and it's, as you said, it's 3 hours 18 minutes long. But all the screen time he's in there, he kind of dominates and steals scene after scene.
You know, I thought you did such a great job of bringing all of the stars to life as people in this book. I mean, I got a sense of who they were in terms of their backgrounds and not just kind of the image we have of them. How did you go about doing that?
Well, I read a lot, and I read a lot of memoirs autobiographies and so on, and I just absolutely fell in love with just about everybody in the book. I thought they were all so fascinating. And there were people like Henry Wilson, this guy I didn't know anything about, who was this agent to many, many stars in that period. He was a very flamboyant figure in Hollywood. I just found him fascinating. And I'll tell you another name, and I bet would surprise many of your listeners. There's one of James Dean's early love affairs was with a woman named Dizzy Sheridan, and she is Seinfeld's mother in the Seinfeld.
it all fits together. Well,
yeah.
Particularly when you were talking about this agent, I really was fascinated by the way you exposed sort of the sordid reality behind the star maker machinery in Hollywood back then. In fact, I confess I made a note along the way that what a sewer this glamorous industry seemed to be behind the scenes. And sexual exploitation wasn't just a phenomenon for the women either. The men obviously were struggling with this as well.
I was going to say Henry Wilson ran one of the major casting couches there. Yeah, it was Henry Wilson always expected the young men who came to him to participate with him sexually, and if they didn't, he'd just go on to the next guy. But he's the guy who gave Rock Hudson his name, and he's the guy who really made Rock Hudson, who had no experience at all and who was a truck driver, but eager to become a star. And Henry Wilson saw him and gave him, trained him and paid for his education and got him hooked up with Universal Studio, and the rest is cinematic history.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, and Hudson is obviously kind of the classic example of the difference between the manufactured Hollywood image and the man he was in real life. I couldn't help but feel sorry for him and kind of having to live a lie all those years.
Yeah, it was tough, and he had it's interesting, his wife, he married this woman, everything was arranged by Henry Wilson, like he was the one said, Rock, you've got to marry this woman, because if you don't, the sex magazine out here, Confidential, is going to expose you. It shouldn't be called a sex magazine, but it was a expose magazine, and it was just as bad being gay in Hollywood, publicly gay, as it was being a communist in the 1950s. And so he married Phyllis Gates and was married to her for about a year and a half, and that gave him the liberty to then divorce her, and nobody ever bothered him about his not being married again.
And you talked about a little bit about James Dean, and wow, what a truly bizarre character he comes across as in the book, and I mean, the things that people would say. I love the Broadway writer who called him, quote, one of the most unspeakably detestable fellows I ever knew in my life. That's pretty strong language.
Yeah, well, nobody had a neutral opinion about James Dean, and I was astounded at the number. People that met him only for 5 or 10 minutes or only had an hour's contact with him, they never forgot it. And many of them talked about it, and a lot of them wrote books about him. It's astounding. The Dean chapter took me, I don't know how many months of reading, because it was kind of new to me, to tell you the truth. I didn't know that much about Dean, but I found him an absolutely fascinating guy. And I guess that's the reason there have been so many memoirs and biographies written about Dean.
You're listening to True Story. This show is a copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I'm Brian Freeman. My latest thriller is The Voice Inside. It's the follow-up to The Nightbird, which was one of the top 20 best-selling Kindle books of 2017. I'm talking with Don Graham about his new book, Giant, which tells the behind-the-scenes story of the making of one of Hollywood's classic films. The book is available tomorrow from St. Martin's Press. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the director. George Stevens was really the man who brought this film to life, and ultimately he won the Best Director Oscar for Giant. What really interested me in your book was his experiences during World War II and how that shaped him as a movie maker. How did that influence the kind of film that Giant became?
Well, that's extremely important. And just a brief bio bit, he photographed scenes at Dachau, and he spent some time there, and he was completely ripped apart by the suffering and the horrors of those when they opened those concentration camps, particularly that one. And it affected him so much when he came back to the States that he wasn't able to work for about 3 years. And he became very depressed and withdrawn and so on. But he did make his way back to making films, and he had a new seriousness, and his work changed. And he made A Place in the Sun, which won him an Academy Award, starred a young Elizabeth Taylor in 1951. Then he made the movie Shane, and then he made Giant. So that's kind of his American trilogy, post-war trilogy. And in the film, there is a young Mexican worker, vaquero, on the ranch who joins the army to fight in World War II, and he comes back his remains, when his remains are brought back, there's a long sequence without any talking at all. It's like a silent movie where his body is picked up at the train station by his family, and then he's buried in a Mexican cemetery. And Rock Hudson, the rancher, goes there and gives that family a Texas flag in honor of his service. And it's a very important moment in the film because Rock Hudson has been a racist all the way through, and then
right.
he begins to change towards the end. At any rate, Jack Warner and everybody said this scene is too long. The movie's already too long. You've got to cut it. You've got to cut it. But Stevens wouldn't do it, and it's a beautiful sequence. And he was so strong-willed about and knew what he wanted to do, but he wanted to get that post-war agony in there of the remains of these soldiers being returned. And that's just the prime example of it. The other thing, the famous diner scene where Rock Hudson is beaten by this racist cafe owner, that too was spurred by what Stevens saw. Stevens was afraid that this discrimination in America might get out of hand. And so he very boldly, very daringly and innovatively put this theme of discrimination into the film, and it played right into the 1954 Supreme Court decision outlawing segregation. And it was that makes that film still very timely in one way.
I was going to say, it seems like a lot of the racial themes, the gender themes in Giant, which struck me as extraordinarily bold for the 1950s, they're still playing out 60 plus years later.
They are, and it was really interesting the reaction of people at the time, because a lot of people in Texas weren't much aware of discrimination against Mexican Americans, because that only occurred mostly in South Texas and West Texas. Whereas everybody saw the film, knew what that sign meant, the sign that, you know, said we reserve the right to refuse service to anybody. They thought it all referred to blacks, African-Americans. But Stevens brought it home in a special way to Texas that there was widespread discrimination against Mexican-Americans as well. Oh, the other very timely theme is Elizabeth Taylor's very surprising feminism. There's a great scene in there when she dresses down her husband and these other men because they won't let her talk to them about politics. You remember that one?
Yeah.
So what
led you to want to do a behind-the-scenes look at this particular film?
Well, I teach the film in my course at the University of Texas, and I saw the film when I was 16 years old. I've always remembered the film. I've always thought it was great. My wife and I visited out in Marfa in 1986 when remnants of the house was still standing there. And the fact is, I just was writing other books, and then finally around, 2006 or 7, somewhere around there, I decided maybe I'd better write a book about Giant. And it turned out to be really a lot of fun, and I just got caught up in all these lives and all the stuff I was learning about what was going on behind the scenes. And I just thought it was a great story about a great movie and about Texas during the 1950s and about America as well.
Well, I always feel like I can tell when a writer is having fun when they're working on a book when I'm reading it. And it certainly seemed like you were having a lot of fun in putting Giant together.
Yeah, and I wanted, you know, there are quite a few film books that I think they get bogged down in two close attention to little bits and changes between the script and what's on the screen and so on. So I didn't want to get bogged down like that. I wanted it to be a narrative that kept moving. And so that's when I hit on the idea of doing these kind of mini biographies in there. So
right.
I think that's what keeps the book going.
It does. I thought that was a great technique. I mean, you kind of feel like each of the stars then gets sort of their own little mini book inside the book as a whole. So
exactly.
Now,
and then James Dean gets a special chapter because
he does.
His death. Right.
Right. Now, obviously, you're a Texas man. So I want to talk. How does How does Giant fit into the Texas ethos now? I mean, it seems like Giant started out in Ferber's book by bringing a pretty dark outlook on the state, but it's kind of almost like Texas got the last laugh because it wound up as this big classic movie with big classic stars, which is
right.
Very, very Texas.
And the movie was wildly successful in Texas in 1956 when it was released, and Texans embraced the movie and just, you know, kind of forgot about Edna Ferber and the novel, and it was a complete reversal of what somebody might have expected. Then Texans continued to, you know, to see the film as kind of a big size, an important statement about the state. They could be both proud of the landscape, the way it's represented in the film, and the characters, and so on. It's also a big family story as well. It's also a story of a marriage. It's got a lot of things going on, but I don't think there's a Texan that ever walked out of the theater that didn't feel good about that film and the way it represents, you know. I don't know I've never been connected with oil men or with ranching, but those are two sort of very important symbolic and realistic aspects of economic aspects of life in Texas in that period. And it's just captured brilliantly. The clash between oil and ranching is captured brilliantly. And Texans continue, I run into people all the time who tell me that they love the film, but they're all about 40 or 50 or 60 now. And so I teach millennials, and the millennials wind up liking it, but they complain about the length, and I tell them, well, do you ever go to a University of Texas football game? And because it's about the same length. But anyway, they wind up liking it. And they've never, by the way, the millennials don't know who Rock Hudson is.
Sure.
They've heard of Elizabeth Taylor, but they know who James Dean is.
Ah, interesting, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I like the quote from George Stevens, who said that the movie is a world of upright things and tall men, which sounds a lot like Texas.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Now, I'm curious, do you think that, because I was interested in seeing, you know, particularly from the writer's perspective, the extent to which Edna Ferber was sort of on the outside pushing back on a lot of things that she saw in the script of the movie. And I kind of had the impression that it was actually Stevens' decision to allow more growth in the characters, particularly in Hudson's character, that
absolutely
helped people embrace that film and that character in a way they would not necessarily have done if they followed Ferber's vision.
Absolutely. That's one of the big weaknesses in Ferber's book, is that the Texas males in there all remain like unrepentant racists, and that includes Big Benedict, the rancher, or Jordan Benedict, because at the end, in the diner scene in the book, he's not there, and the family gets thrown out for having this little Mexican child with them. So the book's depressing, really, because it indicates that nothing has changed in this 25-year marriage that this woman has been in Texas. And the other thing about the book is Leslie's a nag. She talks all the time in the book. So Stevens humanized her, and he made Rock Hudson go through an arc in which he changes from being a racist to accepting his mixed-race grandson at the end, and also he gets beaten in the diner scene, and he feels terrible about that. He feels like he's, you know, he's been a failure, and she tells him at the end, this is the most successful thing you've ever done in your life. So it really has a powerful lesson at the end.
I love the
and
way
Ferber,
you write
Ferber
about
didn't have
yep.
that.
I love the way you write about Texas, by the way. I mean, I thought your descriptions really make the place come to life. I mean, it has the passion of a Texan writer, but I just felt like I was down in Texas in your descriptions of the places and the set and how it all came to life.
Oh, I like that. Sounds good.
The book is Giant, The Making of a Legendary American Film by Don Graham, and it is available tomorrow, April 10th, from St. Martin's Press. Don, if people want to learn more about you and your book, where can they go?
Well, the New York Times today carried an interview with me, and it's pretty insightful, I think. And gosh, I don't know. I've got a number of books out there. I guess they could go to the UT website and look me up on the English department. That has some information.
Well, the book is just terrific. I encourage everyone to go out and take a look at it. I think you will thoroughly enjoy not only the writing, but just the fascinating story behind the scenes of the film. Don, I want to thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, it was a real pleasure. I enjoyed talking to somebody up there in that cold weather.
Well, we could use some of the Texas heat up here in Minnesota right now. I'll say that.
Absolutely.
This is
Thanks
Brian Freeman. Thank you. This is Brian Freeman, and you have been listening to True Story on the Authors on the Air Network. Be sure to visit authorsontheair.com for more interviews with best-selling writers in every genre. That's authorsontheair.com. And if you want to find out more about my best-selling thrillers, and you know you do, you can visit my website at bfreemanbooks.com. That's bfreemanbooks.com. And set your calendar for May 1st, because my 15th thriller, Alter Ego, will be arriving in bookstores on May 1st. I will keep you posted on upcoming editions of Dory, and in the meantime, thanks for listening and happy reading.